I'm Joseph.
And I'm Nick.
And this is Fish Jelly. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay.
Yeah.
It's Saturday.
Yeah.
We're recording this a day early.
Yes.
Because you're flying away later today.
I am.
So hope that goes well.
Same. Yeah. Yeah.
Where to begin? We watched Monique's interview on Club Shay Shay with good old Shannon Sharp. This is after the tidal wave that was Cat Williams' interview. And I mean, people are saying that if Cat Williams was, you know, shooting shots, Monique dropped bombs. I thought Cat Williams seemed a little more out of control, but
I agree. And, you know, Monique, because we follow her pretty closely, really, anyway, with interest. So she didn't say anything new to me. With the gripes she has, with the people she has, that those were all things I've heard before.
Yeah, I guess, like you said, because we are very familiar with her work, and I'm a big fan of hers. Yeah, none of this was really that shocking.
I think what is happening now is suddenly Shay Shay is providing a platform for people to get on
and air their grievances.
And everybody's paying attention. So it's all of this energy is being funneled in the same way or towards the same thing.
I have so much to say about this.
Well, let's get into it.
Where to even begin? So for people who don't know, Monique, who spells her name, her professional name, M-O-apostrophe-N-I-Q-U-E.
Shade.
And I'm saying this because Shannon Sharp, who I think seems like a really nice guy, and I do enjoy him, he says, "What he asked her, why do you spell your name M-O apostrophe or
hyphen
N-I-Q-U-E? And I'm like, okay, well, it's not a hyphen, it's an apostrophe. Surely she will correct him.
She does not.
And then she spells her name and she goes, well, I spell my name M-O hyphen N-I-Q-U-E. And I just thought, girl.
Which is funny because they also talk about Monique's history with education, which.
Oh, I have I just have so much to say about her because I have liked her since The Parkers, which I did watch. I remember her because, you know, The Parkers is a spinoff from Moesha because Moesha's best friend, Kim, would always talk about her mom. And we never saw her until we finally did. And it was Monique. And then that's what led to the spinoff. So as a comedian, I think she's like A plus. As an actor, like in that sitcom was great. Obviously she won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for the film Precious back in 2000.
Based on the novel Push by Sapphire. Yes.
What was the year? 2000?
2009.
But her career took a very serious downturn when she refused to do international press for the film Precious after it was getting Oscar buzz. And then she talked about why she didn't, and she brought up some pretty powerful names like Tyler Perry and Oprah Winfrey. And then she just didn't work anymore. And of course said that she had been blackballed.
Well, she bit the hand that was feeding her, which was Lee Daniels.
And then so she had a very dry spell for a long time. Then she sort of reignited the blackballing flame by complaining that Netflix didn't offer her an amount that she thought was.
They lowballed her.
She feels like they lowballed her because she's a legend. And then they pay Amy Schumer $13 million, and they only offer her like $250,000.
And for a special, that ended up being very so-so. So,
and then eventually did the special, and then it was so-so, and probably the most remarkable thing. And that special came out last year.
Oh, I meant Amy Schumer's, but
oh no. Well, but it got streams, so that's what they paid for. And we already talked about that. But and then Monique went on to years later do a Netflix special, and I'm assuming they paid her enough to feel good about. And that was fine. She came out as queer kind of in that special, but then has not brought it up since. Certainly didn't bring it up in this interview, which we can talk about.
Well, I don't think Shay Shay knows how to talk to gay people.
Probably not. But I don't think that he's not gay friendly. Just don't think it's in the scope. I mean, he seems to have a limited scope anyway.
But, and clearly doesn't like confrontation. But no.
Which I think is part of his charm because he is this very imposing figure physically. Like he's big and he's very muscular, but then he seems like a cuddly teddy bear.
Well, he doesn't control the room.
No. And so, I think that's what's probably going to allow him to continue to do this and not be ridiculed or take heat from it, because he's just kind of like the nice guy who's letting you talk on camera. But yeah. Anyway, so Monique gets on, and I'm just going to go through the things that popped out to me. So first of all, she is married to this man, Sydney Hicks. And is his name.
I know.
And she refers to him as her king. She has children with him. He's her manager. And for years now, when you hear about her, people often talk about her being difficult because of Precious, but also people talk about how they don't like the fact that her husband is a manager is a problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't work in entertainment. It does feel odd to be represented, like to know that she's represented by her husband.
Well, it's just, it's a situation that is allowed, but there are clear conflicts of interest, I think, in some of those relationships.
But of course, I don't know. It's just like, that's what you always hear about Monique, is that her husband's her manager and she's difficult to work with. He's difficult to work with. But the thing that stuck out to me first is Shannon asked, how did you two meet? And she goes, oh, we've known each other since I was 14, like since we were kids. He's a brother to me. Like she kept saying, like, he's like my brother. He's like my brother.
That became her daddy.
And then she likes to call him daddy, and that he raised her, which we can talk about. But so keeping that in mind, we know that Monique has talked about, and her another brother of hers, because she has two brothers, I believe. One of her brothers molested her as a kid. And that brother actually went on Oprah, which we can talk about too. But knowing that she was molested by her brother and she's traumatized from that, I just find it so odd that she describes her now husband as like this person she's known since she was a kid who is like her brother.
With incestuous terms.
You couldn't count on two hands. Like, you wouldn't have enough fingers to count on two hands the number of times she refers to him as her brother. And then when she describes the moment that switch turned to him being her lover, it's very odd.
It's interesting. It's interesting in a way that whatever works for them that's healthy and consensual is great, but what would be more fascinating is somebody that asks the correct questions.
So the reason I bring it up is because I just found it so strange that a woman who has that sort of history of sexual abuse with a family member, and then the way she describes her husband as being not only her brother but her father, and like someone who raised her, and says that he took her out of being like this angry 15-year-old girl. But then also, you know, in this interview she didn't, but in other interviews and on stage she talks about the sex, and she talks about their open relationship, and she's talked about having sex with women, which of course she avoided talking about in this interview.
Well, she also was not asked.
But she wasn't asked. But the reason I brought it up is because it's interesting, but also I think Monique's problem after listening to her for 2 hours talking to Shannon Sharp is she has this pious nature to her. And people make fun of her for like, baby, baby, listen, I love us, my sister, my brother, I love. She just acts like she's like this, like, soothsayer or something. But then it's like, you seem to have troubles, because when you describe your life, it sounds like you've had a lot of issues. You made a lot of poor decisions, including the one that has kept your career in the toilet for the past 12 years. Why would we listen to you? She says something about like she wishes she could take her husband and put him in a bottle and so give him
so that other black women could experience what love from a real black man, a black king is like.
And I'm not a black woman, but I'm certain that there are black women out there who would hear Monique and think, bitch, who the fuck are you talking to? Like, you have... I just don't think she's very self-aware.
She's not, and it speaks to it. She sounds brainwashed, okay? And
she does.
And I should preface this saying I also find her fascinating and talented, and I will always watch her. But she seems condescending and patronizing.
I agree. I think, listen, because, and this is based off me knowing her for decades as an entertainer and hearing the things she says. We know that she had a rough childhood. She suffered abuse. She was not a good student, certainly not scholastic. She was in special education because She probably had a learning disability. The way she describes it is like she's half dumb and half bored.
See, I don't think she's dumb. I just think she doesn't want to do what she doesn't want to do, which is something I can relate to.
She's also described making a lot of poor business decisions, not understanding the business, which has affected her money, namely the fact that she's on a syndicated show, The Parkers, and is not getting the kind of money. She's not giving numbers in that regard. So I don't necessarily trust like what she's saying, because she's certainly getting residuals.
Yes.
She's just acting like she's not getting.
Well, that's the reason those details aren't being trotted out here like all the others is because she has created a persona of martyrdom.
Right. So I think what I'm trying to say is I imagine that Monique is difficult, because if all you ever talk about is, baby, I love us, my sister, positivity, I don't come for anyone. If that's really true, then why do very few people in the industry fuck with you? Why have you won an Oscar and then 13 years later still don't really...
Only been in five or six movies.
You've only been in five or six movies, and they're not like mainstream things. Like, no one's checking for you. She does tell a story about Will Packer, because she says there's only one person in the industry who would say anything negative about me. And I think, I don't know that that's like, that can't be right, because you'd be working all the time.
This interview was full of contradictions.
Full of it. Mm-hmm. But she talks about Will Packer, who is a notable producer, mm-hmm. Who produced the film Almost Christmas, which I recall really enjoying Monique in that movie.
She's the highlight. Gab Union is pretty good in that
too. Yes, but she plays an auntie. Mm-hmm. And she says that the man who directed that movie, mm-hmm. whose name I don't recall anymore.
Is it Malcolm D. Lee who directed that?
Maybe. But whomever directed Almost Christmas is a friend of her husband's. So when the friend asked if Monique would be in it just as a cameo, she agreed, because the money was, you know, not where she would want it to be, but she did it as a, they did it as a favor. Because of course, anything she does has to be with her husband. But when she got on set.
Oh, sorry. David E. Talbert.
David E. Talbert. That's who I'm talking about. Because he was a friend, she decided to do this cameo in Almost Christmas. But when she got on set and she was killing it, he was begging her, like, please do more, please do more. And that's how her part got bigger. But then she talks about how Will Packer was so unprofessional, how he was talking down to the director, and she had to take a stand for the director because she couldn't see this black man be spoken to this way, and that other people who were around thanked her for sticking up to Will Packer. And then she also tells a story about how their trailers blew up because the gas wasn't attached to them properly. And apparently there's proof of that. So, you know, she tells this story, which I felt like, I don't know, just everything Shannon asked her, everything she says, she has that response that drives me crazy, where she wants to put it back on you, mm-hmm. to make you agree. So if you ask me, like, was I upset that this thing happened, and then my response is, well, would you be upset? And it's like, don't worry about what I think.
Right.
Bitch, I'm asking you. Mm-hmm. And can you just, like, he even asked her, like, oh, when you auditioned for Moesha, and she goes, I didn't just audition for Moesha. And then Shannon's confused, mm-hmm. because, bitch, you were on Moesha. Mm-hmm. You played Kim's mom. Oh, I didn't audition.
And then goes on to say that she does not, has never done, and will not.
And then tells a story about that, how she's never auditioned, she's offer only. And it's just like, bitch, you sound difficult.
So then that's one of the things I like about her, though. It just own it. Just be difficult. You can be difficult.
Well, then let's segue to the topic.
Be a diva.
The biggest topic of the interview is that she has famously, and this is not new. I mean, I've known this for a while, because she went on T.S. Madison's YouTube show and mm-hmm. talked about it. But even before that, Monique has said that she recorded Tyler Perry apologizing for sullying her name.
Uh-huh.
Specifically, Monique says that she was offered the role of Cookie in Empire.
Uh-huh.
But because Tyler Perry was telling people Monique was difficult, Monique says that she was told that she was not going to be offered the role of Cookie because she was known to be difficult. So she confronted Tyler Perry and recorded him, unbeknownst to him. Mm-hmm. But she's saying that in the state she lived in at the time where it happened, recording someone in that way was legal. She recorded him and he apologized, saying that he shouldn't have done that. We haven't heard the recording. No. She just She just shares it with other people like T.S. Madison
and like Shannon.
Like Shannon. And then they confirm, like, yes, what I heard is what she's saying.
Not only confirm it, she asks them to say what they heard him say.
Okay, but here's the thing. So she's saying, because Tyler Perry said I was difficult, I lost out on work. And at that time, I was making $2 to $3 million per year. Mm-hmm. And my career has been in the toilet for the past 12 years. So I believe Tyler Perry owes me $2 to $3 million per year for 12 years.
And see,
basically what she's saying.
And I disagree with that.
And I don't know that I agree with her at all, because if, and this is probably what you're going to say, so I'll let you say it.
Well, okay. So he apologized for saying you were difficult, but you were difficult. He thought you made something difficult for him. He thought you were difficult. Sure, it was unprofessional of him to say, and that had ripple effects. Look at what happened to Mira Sorvino and Ashley Judd because of Weinstein. But you were being difficult. You need to back up and take stock of what motivated him to say that.
That's my problem with her, is like, this man thought you were difficult and he told people, and listening to you in this interview, you sound difficult. Every story you tell, every response you make, you seem difficult. So where's the lie?
I remember in,
I'm not defending Tyler Perry, but I'm not, like, either, where's the lie?
I remember in 2009 thinking, like, well, good for her, she's refusing to campaign and do this goddamn circus dance that we all have to be privy to every year for the Oscars. But, you know, the message she was sending was that she doesn't work for free. So, and these actors don't get paid for promotion. But there are complex issues that she's refusing to delve into about what these people probably thought when she refused to go to Cannes.
Let's talk about that. So getting to her not wanting to promote Precious. So she says that what was in her contract, which is why she's never been sued, she likes to point out, mm-hmm. which again makes you seem difficult. Like, so, but anyway, she says that she was under contract to promote Precious under Lee Daniels Productions. And she did that. She went on Oprah. She did a bunch of magazine covers and interviews for the film under Lee Daniels Productions. But when the film started getting buzz and then they were presenting at Cannes, that's when Lionsgate, the distributor, asked her, could you please go to Cannes? Because we think you did such a great job promoting in the US and we really think you have a shot. And basically, I'm not going to tell the full story, but she says that her husband, who represents her, told them that we don't work for free. And unless there's a fee associated with it, we're not going. And then they were told, we don't pay for people to do press,
but they will pay for you to stay in France as long as you goddamn want.
So here's my issue with this, and this is where I think Monique is also sort of like not relating. Like, if she wants people to sympathize and empathize with her, I think she's a little misguided, because I think to a regular person, you have to invest in your career.
Yeah.
We've all done that. You've flown across country to spy out a job and meet the person who might potentially interview you to get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
And it happened to work out, but even if it didn't, it's like you had to do that to see. I've done a lot of things in my career where it's like, I wasn't getting paid for this. You're asking more from me than I feel like I should be doing, but I'm doing, you know, I took a job at a startup because I thought there could be a lot of opportunity there. Mm-hmm. Even though the pay wasn't that great in the beginning and I was being asked to do a lot of things that were not in my job description, I did it because I thought this is an investment in what my career could be outside of this company, with this company, if it continues to grow. That's the same thing with acting. Like, you only got paid $55,000 to be in Precious and you already satisfied your contractual obligations. But now there's talk about you winning prestigious awards that would put you in a different stratosphere.
When we're talking about Black people in American film,
you know what I think the problem is? I don't think her husband understood what a big deal it was.
Yes.
For her to be invited to do press
in France,
for a critically acclaimed film.
At the most acclaimed film festival in the world. And how many Black filmmakers actually get invited there?
Right.
So, historically.
And I feel like if she would have talked to other actors, they would have told her, bitch,
well, that's
you better pack your bags your fat ass to fucking
Well, I'm friends with at least one bona fide Black actress. And there, I know there are so many people that would have been in her position, black women that could have been in her position that hear her shit and are probably so mad.
Any actor would have jumped at the chance.
You know, okay, so she's collapsing her plight with that of Taraji P. Henson, right? And, you know, part of what Taraji was talking about during all of these past few weeks is combating the notion that black people aren't profitable overseas. And you know that Tyler Perry and Oprah are thinking, this is the Cannes Film Festival. You need there. That is all part of this ongoing conversation in combating those kind of stigmas and stereotypes. And her ignorant ass just sounds like, I needed a check to go there. I don't, it's just disappointing to hear that we haven't, you, like, it's like a dog with a bone. You haven't given up this narrative for yourself instead of realizing that the you kind of shit on all these other people.
I need a segue. So I think a good way to do that is at one point Monique says, if I were a white woman, do you know what my name would be? And she says, Melissa McCarthy. And I just think, like, okay, if that's how you feel, what would Melissa McCarthy have done? Melissa McCarthy would have gone to camp.
She would have gone to camp.
On her, like, and not get paid and uh-huh. stay in a fancy hotel someone else paid for, because that's what Monique was offered. Mm-hmm. She was offered accommodations and travel to Cannes to bring her family to stay a week after Cannes if she wanted for vacation, but they're not going to pay you to go.
Well, and she, because if you just listen to the details, like, well, how come Tyler Perry and Oprah couldn't have paid for her to go? People were offering to pay for her to go, but...
I mean, it's also a business.
Monique is mad that Tyler Perry, because everybody knows Tyler Perry gives what, Cicely Tyson $1 million to.
Yeah, but Tyler Perry paying Cicely Tyson was obviously his choice, but also it was a business, right? Like, that's part of business operations. Like, I'm right. sure they could have found a way to expense, but this is also a business.
But in Monique's attitude, right?
And I keep going back to, I think for this woman who all she does is talk about positivity and I love us and baby and I'm your auntie and I, if you're so great and positive and everyone loves you, why are you not working? Why is no one checking for you? Why is the the common thread about everyone's opinion of you that you're difficult?
Well, it's also weird. I feel like above all other people, Tyler Perry seems to prize black women, black actresses, and the fact that I feel like her approach to him was probably what got him saying what he said to her, because he probably would have given her what she wanted under the carpet, right?
Because she also says that he agreed to meet with her, but not with her husband.
Yeah, see, there are weird
things. And I think that there's something to that. Like, maybe he felt like it's difficult to get through to her when mm-hmm. her husband's around. I don't know. That woman can do whatever she wants to do. She can have her husband be her manager, but it's like, clearly, ever since this has happened, your career has gone in the toilet, and maybe she feels like she can't. I don't know.
It just sounds like when she talks about her husband, it seems creepy, because she's like, he made me a woman. He taught me how to be a woman. And then, you know, we didn't even talk about it. We just moved in together and he sat at the head of the table and I sat at the side. It's like,
oh my God, what? When she talks about that moment, it's like, what are you talking? Again, not relatable. She talks like she's the only person who's in a marriage that is successful, mm-hmm. as she would put it. Like, you did not discover something new. And actually, the way you're talking about it sounds a little toxic. So I don't
know. It sounds like she makes being married to a black king sound like Stockholm syndrome. Like, you sound
okay.
She sounds like she's hostage.
I need to keep going through these notes. She talks about Tiffany Haddish because Shannon Sharp brings up the fact that Tiffany said that, you know, she doesn't do business like Monique and that she doesn't understand, like, her husband being her manager. And then Monique says, well, you know, I don't do business like her. And
maybe if she had a husband,
maybe if she had a husband
like mine,
then she wouldn't be out here making these decisions she's making, like getting DUIs or getting accused of grooming children.
Well, yeah, she wouldn't. She wouldn't, because she'd be hostage in her house.
She talks about Al Sharpton. She says when all this went down, she sent Al Sharpton the recording of Tyler Perry, and Al Sharpton agreed that Tyler Perry should do something about this.
Why? So, because he can? Because he has money?
So Al Sharpton contacted Tyler Perry and then never contacted Monique again. And then Monique says, but then you see Al Sharpton on the news saying we don't have to fly commercial anymore because Tyler Perry is going to let us use his private jet. So clearly, you know, she's implying bought Al Sharpton. Then she talks about Kevin Hart. Kevin Hart telling her, like, I support you. Whatever you want to do, I'll help you. Oh, you want to do a talk show? I'll produce it. So Monique says that now that she has Kevin Hart's name attached to her new talk show she wants to do, it's a win. And so the production company was like, great. Like, if Kevin Hart's attached, we can get this going again. But then she gets a call one day from Kevin Hart's manager saying, Kevin doesn't want to be associated with you. So she calls Kevin Hart to say, why is this white man telling mm-hmm. people that you don't want to work with me? And she says Kevin Hart told her it was a misunderstanding and he'll straighten it out. And that was 2 years ago and she's never talked to him since. Mm-hmm. She says from Tyler Perry, she doesn't say explicitly she wants $24 to $36 million, but she keeps saying it like that's how much she lost. Then she says from Oprah, she wants an apology specifically for bringing Monique's family onto the Oprah show to talk about the abuse and all that mm-hmm. and not respecting her wishes of not having them on. She talks about Lee Daniels and says that their relationship has been mended because he did the right thing by apologizing. That's all she wanted.
But also he's her friend.
She also we're almost out of time for this topic, but she does say at the beginning of the interview that she has a big revelation that she's going to divulge at the end of the interview. Mm-hmm. So it's like, ooh, what is she going to say? Keeping in mind that I was waiting for Shannon to ask her about, like, because she talks about being like a slut and a whore before she met her husband. Mm-hmm. And would have been the perfect intro to like, oh, so you have this open marriage and yeah. you have sex with women. Never mentions it. The big secret she wants to say at the end is that she says that she and Cat Williams are fraternal, spiritual, non-biological twins.
Okay.
Which meant nothing to me. Uh-huh. The last thing I wanted to say is Judge Mathis got on his Instagram after this interview and basically said that he thinks that this needs to stop. These black entertainers getting on the internet, ripping each other down. He's saying it's embarrassing. He thinks that white people are laughing at us.
Like,
what are these studio executives thinking? And I guess I don't know how. So for Cat Williams, who is very independent, like mm-hmm. he funds his own tours, like he backs his own tours. There are no sponsors. He makes good money doing it. People like him for being kind of crazy and irreverent. So him going on Club Shay Shay, I think probably helps ticket sales. Monique's not working because people think she's difficult.
She went on with an agenda to me. She was directing Shannon.
She was fully directing that interview.
Yeah.
But you spend 2 hours to millions of viewers now. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The last time I checked, it had like 5 million views, I think. So now all you've done is solidify the fact that you seem difficult. So what was the benefit of this interview
right.
for Monique?
Right.
It had a benefit for Club Shay Shay. but I don't know what it's going to do for her except make her. I mean, I just can't imagine that Oprah, Tyler Perry are going to want to work with her. I can't imagine any major studios, any networks trying to get her back on TV. All she's proven, because she keeps saying it over and over again, she says at the beginning of the interview, if you do something wrong, I'm going to tell on you. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't work with her. Well, I like her, but I wouldn't work with her.
There's nothing wrong with that.
You're going to tell on me.
Well, no, but.
Because your fried chicken wasn't crispy enough from cater service. Like, I mean.
That's why she's complicated, because I think her heart's in the right place in a lot of things. But it just seems like in these 13 years since Precious and this fallout, you haven't learned anything. What you should have learned is that you need to infiltrate. You need to say what they fucking want to hear.
Well, baby.
Get in there and get into a position to fuck them over if you want to fuck them over still.
Monique, I love you and I love us. And
baby,
I hope you're at home right now with your king, comfortable, eating something good. But we need to take a break.
Okay.
I thought we were done talking about Monique, but I forgot to mention that she also mentions D.L. Hughley mm-hmm. and how they sort of have a feud that started when they were both doing a comedy show and she was contracted to be the headliner, but he refused to go on before her. So he showed up late. And then I watched the clip of her talking about him and she goes in mm-hmm. like on him to the audience mm-hmm. about how she's the headliner. And once she leaves, the headliner has left. So, of course, they've had beef. But she also tells a story about how she was on D.L. Hughley's radio show. But it's kind of like how Kevin Hart has a show, but he's not usually on it. Mm-hmm. He has like a team of well, Kevin Hart's team is kind of remedial to me, but she went on the D.L. Hughley show and he was not on that day. It was other people. And they, she said it was a great interview. Everything was going great. And then they said they wanted to play a game of Would You Rather? And she said, sure. So the game, so then they asked her, would you rather have your husband have sex with a condom with Lee Daniels or without a condom with Corinne Steffens, who's like a hoe? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, she immediately got upset, called D.L. Hughley on his phone. And then his response was, what? That's how we do things. Like,
if anything, she should have said, like, oh, that's one that's kind of disrespectful. But here, this is what I pick, or have some kind of funny response. But to show that you let that bother you makes me think that there are strange things going on in your relationship. Like, it hit a nerve.
Well, I just don't know. Everything out of her mouth makes her seem combative.
Well, right. Like,
and it's just like, I don't know.
You just,
maybe I'm
it.
Sensitive to it because I don't want to be labeled as an angry black person. So yeah, people, when people say things that are, when my boss says something to me that's kind of sideways, I just take it and think like, I don't want to be difficult and there's a time and a place to rectify this. And maybe that's not always the best approach.
Well,
especially considering our secret film today, maybe I shouldn't be so passive. Mm-hmm. But I think, I think she should have done what you said, is address it on air. Like, you know, this question seems real loose and crazy and disrespectful. And what are you saying about like Lee Daniels? Like,
right. But yeah, I'd be like, what is that saying about your friend?
Yeah. What, like Lee Daniels is my friend. Are you saying because he's a gay man that like having like what, my husband's going to get AIDS from having, like, right. she really should have gone in a funny way, yes. and got them together,
yes.
instead of getting mad, not finishing the interview, having her lawyer send a cease and desist, which is why we haven't heard the interview. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's all.
So then D.L. Hughley, I know, has responded, but we haven't listened to it. It's like somebody somewhere has got to be like, I'm above this now. Like, some of this shit was years ago. And also some of the shit that people say about you, who fucking cares? It's just, I feel the same way about Bob the drag queen thinking that he needs to do a diss track to Matty Morphosis because Matty Morphosis called him corny on the pit stop. It's like, but girl, you are corny sometimes, and take it on the chin and move on, because then you make yourself look stupid with this subpar diss track.
Well, that's the problem. I expect drag queens to be catty and read and all the things, but it's like,
that's what got you mad?
That straight white man, I mean, he really did get you together with his comeback. So, and for people who don't know, both parties released like a diss track against each other.
Yeah.
After, as Nick said.
Well, you, and you put them on, so I imbibed. And I have to say,
well, Bob's diction is poor. His rhymes were kind of whack. And then Maddie just came back and,
well, it's just like, you think your dig is to say he looks like Miss Vito Boheme from Tu Wong Fu? Girl, please. Like, let's get into 2024, shall we?
Anyway, moving on to the restaurant section.
Anyway, more things I hate.
So on Melrose, there near where we are, there are three restaurants, and the name. So there's a restaurant called Osteria Buca.
Oh, are you talking about when you dropped me off the wrong place?
Well, there are three restaurants: Osteria Buca, Osteria Mama, and Osteria Masa, and they're all on Melrose. They're all close to each other. And so we ordered pizza from one of them last week. Mm-hmm. And this is during like the torrential rainfall of 2024 here in LA.
Yeah, monsoon season.
Monsoon season. So, and of course, we wouldn't dare order delivery in bad weather because I think that's really shitty.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're like, you know, disabled. Like, I mean, like if you can't get out of the house.
Yes.
But
we are able bodied men that can fend for ourselves.
Because I see our neighbors ordering. We have a neighbor who orders
most
delivery, like most of their meals.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we're staying like multiple times a day,
but
every day.
Also, you save a lot of money getting the shit yourself.
And he's an able-bodied person.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going on. But anyway, we ordered this pizza in the torrential rainfall, and I drove you to go to the restaurant, and I had chosen the wrong restaurant. But I feel like it's not my fault. There are three restaurants called Osteria on the same street, within walking distance.
But I said the name, like, oh, I'm going to get it from here. And he's like, you're like, that's the one that's right next to us. I'm like, oh, is it? Okay, well.
But to talk about that pizza. Oh, my God. Because what's the style? Napolitano. And I always have such fond memories of 2009 in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the film festival. These people fucked up because they didn't know Nick Bell because they're Neapolitan.
Jeanette Napolitano.
Yeah. They had a pizza place near the venue where all the films are being shown during the St. Paul Minneapolis Film Festival called Blaze Pizza.
Punch Pizza. Blaze is that.
Blaze is that change. Pizza, yeah. Punch Pizza. And they were doing this thing during the film festival that was for every movie ticket you have, you get a free pizza. Like one entire pizza.
Yeah.
But most people are only going to one, two, whatever. I don't know. But Nick.
Oh, I was going to four or five a day.
Like days worth.
And when I discovered that the ticket didn't have to be on the same day.
Oh my God. So that year, we had so many punch pizzas in the house, in the refrigerator. First of all, to this day, those are still the best Neapolitan style pizzas I've had, and I just have such fond memories of we had to have had like 30 of them.
Oh yeah, you know, in like a 10-day period.
Yeah, but anyway, the pizzas we got from Osteria.
I don't need to get that again.
Ugh. Yep. That crust tasted like I've never had such bland.
The pizza to me is a problem in LA. There are very few places that I've been pleased with pizza.
I mean, honestly, sometimes because we've paid good money for pizza that I'm like, we should have just went to Papa John's because I mean, I would have not been as disappointed and only had spent $20.
Yeah.
But we've spent very good money on pizzas that were so mid.
I forget the name of that place in Beverly Hills that was really good, though.
I know one of our listeners lives near there.
But I could go back there. But anyway, this was very disappointing.
But really, my gripe is about there being three restaurants with similar names on the same street within walking distance.
Well, all overpriced and all a little. Like, we've been to two of them and a bit disappointing.
Films released we didn't cover. Out of Darkness.
Yes, it's an old Stone Age film directed by Andrew Cumming, which, I mean, I knew it was coming out. You just said you didn't want to watch it, so I didn't pursue it, and it came out.
Cobweb.
I liked this. I saw it. It was at Cannes.
We reviewed something called Cobweb.
Yeah, that was a terrible film. That was a horror movie.
People didn't like that we didn't like it.
They didn't? Okay. Well, whatever. I didn't like it.
That's the girl in the wall?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that story was ridiculous.
It wasn't very. Anyway. There were interesting things. I didn't like it. I liked this version of Cobweb. Kim Ji-woon's latest, which played in, I think, the Midnight section at Cannes last year. Which I didn't see. So I saw it at AFI Film Fest this year, starring Song Kang-ho as a film director. Is it a period piece in the 70s where he's trying to remake this horror film? He's trying to reshoot the last scene and he doesn't have the authorization to do so. So there's some kind of subversive political statements about the film industry at the time. And it's this weird kind of horror soap opera. And it's a lot of fun, I thought.
Drift.
I didn't like this film. Anthony Chen, who we brought up because his film The Breaking Ice, which he made after this, was recently released. And I didn't like that either. Oh. But this stars Cynthia Erivo and Aaliyah Shawkat, who are both on this Greek island. Shawkat is this Greek tour guide. Well, she's not Greek, but she's giving tours to places on this island. And Cynthia Erivo is a refugee from some war-torn country. She's unhoused, living on the streets, and the two women become friends. And just none of it worked for me. Not a moment of it.
Ennio?
Oh, this 2.5 hours. I didn't have time this week. Giuseppe Tornatore has directed a documentary about who arguably is the greatest film composer of all time, Ennio Morricone. So I will see this eventually. I didn't have time this week.
The Monk and the Gun.
This was Bhutan's official submission for the international category, the international film feature category at the Oscars this year. And I think it made the shortlist, directed by Paolo Choining Dorji, which sounds fun. Maybe I'll see it one day, but it came out this week.
The Taste of Things.
We almost saw this. You agreed to see it. I saw it at Cannes last year. It was in competition from the Vietnamese film director Tran Anh Hung, who I'm a fan of. Scent of Green Papaya is beautiful.
Is this that one that the person you know asked us to watch?
Yes, to cover it. So I do have a review out there for it. And actually this Sunday, they're having a very... So it's a foodie film. It's a period piece with Juliette Binoche and Benoit Magimel, who are ex-husband and wife.
Were you going to say on Sunday there's an event where I could get food and watch it?
Yeah.
Oh.
But they're having like a several course meal before the screening. Because this
I'll go see the meal.
Oh, okay. I'll go see the meal, not the movie. The movie's in it. I think Binoche is quite lovely in the film. I think this was also shortlisted. I don't think
I'm not interested in watching it. I just, we don't have time. There's too much going on.
And it is long. And yeah, it's just the timing this week.
If you would have been around tomorrow, I would have agreed to go get the meal and the movie.
Same, but we're not. And maybe you'll see it eventually. And it is a sumptuous film. If you see this film, I would agree, don't see it hungry.
Oh, well, that's like watching the Food Network hungry.
Yeah, no, don't do it.
Projects of interest, High and Low.
Which this is ironic based on what our secret film is this week, but A24 and Apple TV are allowing Spike Lee and Denzel to reunite for, how many times is it now? Five? Is this the fifth time? Anyway, Spike Lee's going to remake Kurosawa's classic kidnapping noir drama High and Low, which means I need to rewatch that because I've only seen it once and it was 17 years ago, which is an excellent film. I mean, most of Kurosawa's work is excellent, but so I'm excited to actually just, that's a great excuse to rewatch this movie when I get back. But granted, this will probably be sometime next year, but to me, that's very exciting.
Adam's interest.
Laura Wandel, Belgian filmmaker, whose debut Playground I thought was very excellent and difficult to watch, about this young girl who's witnessing her slightly older brother being bullied at school and the adults clueless about helping them. It's an upsetting film, but highly watchable. It's also very short. She's doing a new project. I have no idea what it's about, but this will most likely be a 2025 film.
Dardenne brothers are doing something?
Yes, they every other year they seem to have a new film and they're getting up there. So, and almost always I like what they do. You haven't seen
I want to say that whenever, like, because thinking about like the Coen brothers, because we just watched Drive Away Dolls,
which is by one Coen brother,
right? Yeah. But like, and then knowing like Dardenne brothers, I feel like whenever a group or like saying that they're like the Coen brothers, I always thought were very young.
No.
Because they're called brothers?
Sure.
But then I realized that who I was thinking of were those two black gentlemen who are directors.
The Hughes brothers.
I always thought the Coen brothers were the Hughes brothers. So whenever people would say, oh, it's a Coen brothers movie, the image I had in my head were of the two black guys.
Well, and they have separated. They've been doing their own things for a while now, too.
But then hearing Dardenne brothers, I think, oh, they must be young.
Nope.
Because whenever I hear brother, I always think like, kids.
No, these are like
the Coen brothers are old white men.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. Well, old, I mean they're probably 50s.
They're not old.
They're not old. The Dardennes are probably pushing 80, but
well, Drive Away Dolls was so out of touch, I assume like an 80 year old directed that.
Well,
anyway, continue with the Dardenne brothers.
The Hughes brothers must be late 40s at least too by now, but or older. Anyway, again, they usually don't release a lot of things ahead of time unless they nab some notable French actor or actress to headline some of the, as they have with some of their later projects. But they have a new film that's shooting, I guess, August to October of 2024.
Featherwood.
Okay, so I'm not really the biggest fan of ScarJo, but she's headlining a film called Featherwood, where I think she's got some kind of an addiction issue and she's undercover and trying to expose some Aryan Brotherhood and is it Texas or somewhere. That's what I remember. But the exciting part is that it's going to be Andrea Arnold directing. So that will be a nice big deal for Ms. Arnold, which makes me excited.
Lastly, something called Famous.
A Jody Hill production where Zac Efron will be playing two roles. One is somebody who's very famous and one is a doppelganger who travels to meet his famous lookalike. So I don't know if this is going to be like Bowfinger or something a little darker, but...
That sounds interesting.
It could be interesting. I mean, I like doppelganger shit. I find that interesting, but yeah.
Unfortunately, there is an entry in the obituary section. Toby Keith died.
I didn't see that.
Yeah.
He can't have been that old.
He was 62.
Wow. Yeah, that's not that old.
I know that he is a country singer. Mm-hmm. He died from stomach cancer, and he looked pretty, like recent pictures of him, he looked pretty sick. Oh. But my thought about him is that, you know, for country music artists of a particular age, he is more on the sort of progressive side.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, obviously I was fond of that. But yeah, he's gone.
Didn't he sing Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy? Is that him? I'm not up with country music.
Oh.
Didn't he sing that though?
I don't know.
Oh, well, didn't he sing Let's Talk About Me?
My mom. Apparently his biggest song is Should Have Been a Cowboy.
Okay. Maybe. I think my mom used to listen to some Toby Keith.
I recognize his name and what he looks like. And then he did Comedy Central's The Daily Show. So that's probably how I know who Toby Keith is.
Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy is big and rich. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know his music. But yeah, he's gone, everyone. We're going to take a break.
So I was right about the Toby Keith song, I Want to Talk About Me, which if you haven't listened to, I remember thinking it was kind of cute. The song.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
No, that was it.
Did you want that on record?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, because I was wrong about Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy.
I was waiting because I was trying to do the intro for The Secret Film.
Okay, do it. Get it.
The secret film this week was Nick's choice. I asked him to choose something in honor of Black History Month, and he chose the 1992 American epic biographical drama film Malcolm X, directed by the great Spike Lee.
Yes.
Starring Denzel Washington.
Denzel.
So Malcolm X was nominated for several.
Two.
Oh, just two?
Just two, yeah. Isn't that
shocking? Best actor and...
Best costume design for Ruthie Carter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I could go with that too. 202 minutes long. Never seen it.
Same.
What is Malcolm X about? It's a biographical epic of the controversial and influential Black nationalist leader, from his early life and career as a small-time gangster to his ministry as a member of the Nation of Islam and his eventual assassination. That is the entire movie. So this movie came out when I was in high school and it was a big deal. I remember it. It probably wouldn't have been something I would have been drawn to in high school. Mm-hmm. And then as an adult, probably the runtime. Well, also, yeah, I don't know why I haven't watched this movie actually.
I think it was timing and it felt like it needed to be not something casual. I think in my mind it's like, oh, this needs to be something, some kind of associated with some event to sit down and
see. Maybe that's what I feel like. Certain movies like this one, it's like you can't just like plop down,
let's watch Malcolm X today. Yeah. Like, okay,
so I think, you know, doing it for the podcast is a good reason to watch
and
it.
As a kid I had, because I was reading like Maya Angelou and Toni Morrison, and I had a paperback copy that I picked up at a garage sale as like a 12-year-old of the autobiography Malcolm X as told to Alex Haley.
So the screenplay was written by Arnold Pearl and Spike Lee, but it's largely based on the autobiography of Malcolm X.
And there was scripts.
Which was written by Alex Haley.
Yes. And the scripts versions have been floating around forever because a lot of people wanted to make this story. Sidney Lumet, Richard Pryor, and then Spike Lee, I think Pearl still has credit, but Spike Lee basically rewrote this to his own accord. But he had to wrestle this away from Norman Jewison, the director of In the Heat of the Night, who just died recently.
Oh.
Because the producers agreed at the time, like, this needs to be a Black director.
And then the production had some issues because the budget was in question and it was a fight to get more money, I understand. And at a point, like, the studio said, we're not giving any more money, and actually stopped post-production, mm-hmm, because of the budget. And then I was reading that
the studio being Warner Brothers,
that the film eventually was able to be finished with financial assistance from several Black celebrities,
including
Janet Jackson, mm-hmm, but like Magic Johnson, Bill Cosby, Oprah Winfrey, Michael Jordan. So I mean, I that's kind of, I mean, that's such a great story to think that this sort of epic film about a notable Black figure wouldn't have been or seen the light of day, maybe, if it weren't for the help of other notable Black people.
Isn't that, to me, that's disgusting that Warner Brothers, like, Spike Lee, who's, you know, Do the Right Thing was only a couple years prior. He's still a hot commodity, really. I know Mo Better Blues wasn't the biggest hit for him, but like, come the fuck on. You're not going to help him out. The studio's not going to help him out. And see, they didn't like how he got the money he needed to finish it the way he wanted. So they screwed him out of further projects. I forget which one, but they stopped him from being a part of something, some other film that he was trying to write a script for.
So the movie is 3 hours, 22 minutes. We watched it in three sections, mainly because we had an engagement prior to, so we went to go see Problemista, which I loved. But I think had we been able to watch it straight through, I would have needed at least one break.
Sure.
Like, I probably would have said, let's stop at the 2 hour mark and I'll go exercise or something. Not because it's an arduous film. Actually, I think so. My overall impression of the film is it definitely feels like Spike Lee doing like an epic biopic. And I think that it, because typically when you get these sprawling biopics, so think of like, you know, Respect with Jennifer Hudson. I think that's not a good example.
No.
And there aren't a lot of great examples of sweeping biopics. And I think this one works pretty well.
I agree. Yeah. The pacing is pretty good.
And I think it's the pacing. Now, my biggest issue with the film is some of the editing choices and the storytelling. But it almost seems like it's inevitable when you try to cram this much into damn near 3.5 hours, that a lot of things are going to get glossed over. So there are several moments where I felt like, oh, wow, okay, so we're here now. Like, but my overall impression of the film is positive. What is yours?
But same. I mean, to me, it floors me that Denzel Washington did not win Best Actor for this. And compared to Al Pacino winning for Scent of a Woman, because the Academy felt Al Pacino was owed an Academy.
So I'm on record saying I think Denzel is the same in everything, and he's not my favorite. I'm very familiar with his work. I would say this is the best performance
I've seen of him. You haven't seen Glory, huh?
No.
Glory he's pretty good in too.
But he's impressive in it.
Yes.
And but then the downside is that he really does carry this film. I don't think there are any other performances in the film that are even memorable. And that includes Angela Bassett,
who has played both Betty Shabazz and Coretta Scott King.
Y'all know Gamilla.
I think it's so interesting that she has played both of those women. Yeah, I agree. It's not unlike, this isn't as good of a film, but Forrest Whitaker in Lee Daniels' The Butler, right? You have these luminaries all over the film, and it's really just his performance.
So we have 22 minutes to get through this three and a half hour film. I'm just going to start. So the opening of the film is we have narration over the video of the Rodney King beating. And then the end of the film, after Malcolm is assassinated, we get Ossie Davis's actual eulogy over video footage
from '65
of the real Malcolm X, archival footage. I thought that the film opens and closes in a very powerful way. I mean, again, for being so long, it did feel very nicely packaged. So, of course, I have to talk about hair, and Malcolm was known for back in the day they would call him conks, which is basically a relaxer or what people want to call a perm, but so Spike Lee and Malcolm X, Denzel's character, are good friends. And Spike works in a barbershop.
Shorty.
Shorty. And he gives Malcolm a relaxer. And it's pretty, I mean, it's a pretty funny scene.
It's probably the only really funny scene.
And then at a point, Malcolm says, I'm not doing this again, which is also funny because we see that he's kind of addicted.
Yes.
Because people like to call relaxers crack, because once you start, you literally can't stop, because if you do, your hair will break off because the textures are so different, but with the regrowth. But anyway, I thought that was a really good start to the film. Then we get flashbacks to when Malcolm was a kid and his upbringing, and his father, who was a minister, mm-hmm. and spoke a lot about Blacks going back to Africa.
And against the KKK.
And against the KKK. And we get, I think the most powerful shot in the film is we get a visual of these Klansmen on horses riding towards the moon.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I would want a poster of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's eerie and it's mm-hmm. like, yeah, it's such a beautiful image.
Well, a terrifying
image, but I think in the scope of this film, it's just such so beautifully done. But yeah, it's terrifying. Then we learn that Malcolm's mother, who was fair skinned, and of course relating that to a lot of Black women being raped by white slave owners, mm-hmm. that his mother was sort of, she had made a decision that she wanted to have children with a dark skinned Black mm-hmm. man so that her children wouldn't be as fair skinned as her. I thought that was very powerful, that knowing that about his mother and what his father believed in, seeing Malcolm turn into the person he did.
Well, yeah, it explains a lot about his influence in grappling with certain things. Yeah.
That he had a lot of promise as a kid. He was a very good student, mm-hmm. because he ends up being sent off. Like his father was killed suspiciously. They say it was suicide, but then he was like hit in the back of the head and put on a railroad track. And then the mom, because it was deemed suicide, the mom didn't get any life insurance. Yeah. So they were struggling and all the kids had to be separated. So Malcolm got sent off and actually was given a nice education in like an all white school.
The woman that the bigger white woman that he's sent to live with is it Shirley Toler from The Honeymoon Killers?
Oh.
But that reminded me of the Josephine Baker story.
Oh, sure.
Right. Yeah. With all those kids. Yeah.
Yep. So here's the point where I think things kind of get a little like breakneck speed, because we see him as like a very promising young man who is saying he wants to be a lawyer, but of course all the white people are telling him, like, you know, pick something more realistic. Yeah. Like, you're smart, you should be a carpenter. But anyway, we see him being a very promising young man to all of a sudden he's working with Delroy Lindo, doing like
a gangster,
like they're running numbers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, gangster light. Malcolm kind of turns into a gangster, being more violent, but at first he's just running numbers. Then he has an incident with Delroy that forces him to kind of go off on his own, and that's when he gets even more reckless and ultimately gets thrown in prison for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Delroy's a Spike Lee regular as well. He's in Crooklyn and The Five Bloods.
Yeah, I actually did like him in this film.
I thought he's very imposing. It's funny watching him, because you think Denzel is of tall stature next to Delroy Lindo.
Like, he looks petite.
And we forgot to mention Lynette McKee plays the mother.
Oh, right.
Well, so she doesn't work that much, but it's fun seeing her. She's from the Cotton Club.
Oh, also, during his gangster time, he is with... So he's really fond of this woman named Laura, who's a preacher's daughter, and she's very like, well, I can't have sex because it's really pain. I thought this part of the story was also kind of unnecessary.
Sure.
Because Laura, who's the woman in Girl Six,
Teresa Randall.
Yeah. He really wants her, but she won't put out. So he starts dating this white woman who I mean, I know it's not Rebecca Romijn, but she looks like if you mix Rebecca Romijn Stamos and June Diane Raphael.
Yeah, Kate Vernon is her name. She basically throws herself at him. And it's the scene in that club is like, it's clearly a Black club.
And she's the only white spot in there.
But I can't, who are you here with? Who are you here with?
I don't know. I also, I know why it's important that he as a person had this experience, yeah, knowing what he preached later. But the Laura character we see throughout the first half of the film sort of somehow, like we don't have any context, ends up being a sex worker.
Uh-huh. For Teresa Randall, yeah.
Teresa Randall. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very clunkily handled.
It was a little bit.
And the host role she's on, you've never seen prettier prostitutes.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
I thought that was odd too. Mm-hmm. All of those women were beautiful. I mean,
of course it's the 40s,
but the
different expectations.
Of course you would expect prostitutes to be beautiful, but the street they're on. I mean, what's that movie with Omar Epps or Cuba Gooding Jr. and Emilio Estevez?
Judgment Night.
Judgment Night.
Yeah.
The way they paint Chicago is what this street looks like that yeah. these prostitutes are on. So that's what I'm saying. It looks like they're in a post-apocalyptic urban setting. Mm-hmm. But then all these women look like top tier. But anyway, when Malcolm gets sent to prison, he meets a Muslim man mm-hmm. who starts telling him about the Nation of Islam and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who I said there could be a drinking game because the number of times the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is said is it's kind of humorous. But we see him. I also thought the prison segment felt like it was at breakneck speed because, and also confusing because we had already been told that Malcolm was a very good student, very smart. But then when we see him in prison, he's reading that dictionary like he doesn't know how to read.
Basically, yeah. It's like he's had to recalibrate in a way that doesn't quite make as much sense. Like,
I also don't understand like his correspondence with Elijah Muhammad and why they chose him. The man in prison who takes a liking to Malcolm says, "I see something in you." Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is except him being defiant.
Well, he's charismatic. Guard.
But he's corresponding with Elijah Muhammad. And when he gets out, he's earned his master's degree and he goes to see Elijah Muhammad. And like, that's where Malcolm is born. Malcolm X is born. And he starts like doing like activist work and getting his name. His name is getting bigger and bigger. And that's where things become problematic because he's sort of outshining the nation as a whole. And then,
which feels very much crabs in a bucket to me. It's like, shouldn't the fact that he's succeeding be good for all of you?
Yeah. Yeah. But
well, there's a scene where Elijah Muhammad, who's played by Al Freeman Jr., tells him, I think he's like kind of sick in his deathbed, we're made to believe, but he tells Malcolm X that he was chosen by God and after to be a prophet, and after me there will be no more.
I just think that it's
like, how the fuck does that work, sir?
I think I need to, like, I didn't quite understand how this man really thought that any of this made sense. And like, because he says that I would die for a lot, the Honorable yeah. Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't quite, I don't think that it doesn't get to simmer enough in that regard. Like, I think we needed more time. There should have been a larger proportion of time in jail where he really felt this connection to this man he's never heard of or met, to the point where he would devote his life to him. And then when he heard that bullshit about God spoke to me, I created this religion, and once I'm gone, it's gone. My first thought was like, what's going to happen to me and us? And
yeah, what about the rest of us in the housing?
And then it's not until he marries Betty Shabazz, Angela Bassett's character, that she questions, like, where's the money, fool? Like, mm-hmm. all these fools have own houses and mm-hmm. drive nice cars and have all these clothes, and we live in this house they rent for us, and we don't have shit. Mm-hmm. I just find it hard to believe that a man who was hustling about his paper just couldn't see. Like, how could a hustler who didn't play about their money get into a situation where now it's like they don't see they're being hustled mm-hmm. and don't care about money? Mm-hmm. But...
Well, and to see that switch, because, you know, the white woman he's in the relationship with is also associated with all these other toxic, horrible things, cocaine, hair, you know, the eradication of his own culture, basically, is what she stands to represent. But the fact that he never goes back to the arms of a white woman is interesting. One of my favorite scenes is... after he has become notorious in the press, this little white, I assume she's a college student because she's carrying books, comes up to him. And she, I mean, how with the audacity, he's with a group of other people. And she walks right up to him, stops him in his tracks and says, like, I know what my ancestors did. I can't help them. I'm a good white person. What can I do to help you?
She says, what can a white person like me who isn't prejudiced do? And Malcolm looks at her. It walks smooth past her.
He said nothing.
Oh, he did say nothing.
He says nothing.
I didn't hear the nothing part.
Oh, I did. I was like, oh.
Oh, that's even better.
Do you know what that reminded me of? Lady Gaga during during the tragedy of George Floyd's murder, in the cultural aftermath of that, saying something similar, like, well, what can we do? It's like, girl, if you have to ask, you need to be quiet and listen if you need to ask that right now after... What do you need to do? Well, not just do a song with Beyonce, I guess.
Well, getting back to Malcolm's gangster time before he went to prison, he was really wild. I mean, that one, the reason Delroy Lindo takes notice of him is when Malcolm and Spike first start going out, they're dressed like birds, like really bright colors, and everyone's making fun of them. And they walk into a bar, like a lounge, and this man is picking on Malcolm's clothes.
His pinstripe red.
And Malcolm busts him upside the head with a bottle. And that's when Delroy Lindo says, come over here. You have a lot of charisma.
And that guy that gets hit over the head and was like sobbing about it, it's like, well, you were giving this young man shit. So I don't know.
Then we see a point like this is after he kind of does Delroy wrong and has to escape. And then now he's kind of doing his own thing. And he's with the guy from Poetic Justice who has HIV.
Oh, Robert Guinevere Smith.
And they have this Russian roulette scene that was so stressful. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, God, he's an awful person.
Yes.
And then after that, we see him getting his relaxer touched up. Like they're in the house and Spike puts on the relaxer. And for anyone who's never had one, especially back then, that was like straight up lye. Mm-hmm. Like a very like highly alkaline solution on your head and it burns really bad. And you know it's working when it starts to burn. That's when you rinse it out. And they go to rinse him out and the water's been turned off or something. So, of course, Malcolm freaks out because his head's on fire and he dunks his head in the toilet water. Mm-hmm. And then as he's trying to get it out, the police come and arrest him and don't let him rinse it out. So when we see him in court, his hair is all fried and crazy. He looks like Fire Marshal Bill. But, getting back to him in prison, I think... Because then there's that moment when Malcolm has been dealing with the Muslim guy, and it's the point where he's telling him about how you have to pray 6 times a day and get on your knees. I thought that scene was corny because I didn't understand why Malcolm won't get on his knees to pray. Mm-hmm. Like all of it felt like I'm just confused now. Like, did you not know this was a religion and that you're praying? And mm-hmm. I don't fully understand what was his connection to like being Muslim?
To me, like most religions, especially when you're in a dire situation, it's a way to get through. Like it's a way for your mind to get through.
Right.
In a way to community, you know.
Because I didn't read the book, I'm assuming he spoke more about his connection to, but in the film, I don't get a sense of like what drew him
what
to,
this means to, well especially
because he doesn't even go to Mecca until he's already notable. Mm-hmm. And then it's like a thing that people are talking about in the press, and like the CIA follows him there too, which is another part of the movie that I feel is not really, it's almost like they're afraid to say that his assassination might have been associated
with, well especially because of what's come out recently, right?
Yeah, so I think that's a deficit.
Yeah, I think Spike wanted to avoid, he's not trying to make Oliver Stone's JFK, right? Which is all about the conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
So this is about the man, not about stuff that we can't help. And there's only conjecture about potentially, especially in 1992, you know, cause that policeman that just died, that wrote that poison pen letter suggesting the FBI and the CIA were all involved with the Nation of Islam and getting rid of Malcolm X.
After Malcolm becomes a minister and he's doing these rallies, Shorty shows up, Spike Lee's character. And of course, Spike thinks Malcolm is just running game.
Mm-hmm. He's like, let's go in the alley.
Yeah, let's go in the alley and do some coke. And Malcolm's like, no, brother, I haven't had drugs in 8 years and this is my life now. And you need to get with the program. We need to shave this relaxed hair off your head. And then we get a montage of him visiting or trying to catch up with the people he used to know back in the day. Mm-hmm. And that's when we revisit Delroy Lindo and he's in a bad way. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a good scene, but I was kind of frustrated that we never went back to him. Like what? I didn't fully even understand what was going on with his character. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Nation of Islam and them talking about the role of women and...
It's like, oh, we're just placing this new hierarchy. It's such bullshit to me. But talking about like what women are appropriate, it also kind of speaks to eugenics. Like they have to be a certain height and a certain color and it's for the betterment of the race. But it's like, well, isn't that placing some weird expectations?
My general thought about religion is like, how do y'all listen? Because the other thing is like, if I believed in God, I feel like, and this is how I felt as a kid, like, this idea of God and having this feeling in your heart and wanting to be godlike and be a good person so that you can eventually meet God, to me, that is a noble thing. Or if that's your North Star, like a person could do worse. Mm-hmm. But then you go to church, and I remember going to church, and it's like, this man on the pulpit acts like a crackhead, saying all this crazy shit. Uh-huh. And then it's like, and then coming to find out later that he died of AIDS, was probably having sex with men. But mm-hmm. then I remember him preaching about homosexuality is a sin. But whatever. Like, why are we worshiping these men?
Right. That are getting through their own self-loathing at our benefit. Yeah.
And then you hear them say crazy shit like, the woman you need to be with has to be like this, and she has to be half your age plus seven. And like, who? What is this? No. I feel like if God wanted me to do this, he can tell me in my head. Like, I don't need some raggedy man driving a Cadillac who keeps asking me for money every Sunday and Wednesday during Bible study to tell me anything.
Right.
So again, I think for someone who used to be a hustler, for someone who used to run game, I feel like I really needed to understand.
I think that someone like as intelligent as him would have understood that side of what this is.
I do think that what he thought he was doing was good work.
Yeah.
So that part of I'm not questioning like that part of it. I'm just saying that there needed to be like a literal come to Jesus moment, and then I don't get a sense of what his faith is connected to.
Well, especially when another young man comes to him and says, like, I want to be part of the Nation of Islam because I want to be like you. And he's like, well, do you know anything about being Muslim? And the guy's like, well, no.
Right. And then we do have some black Christians who kind of confront him, and they're critical of mm-hmm. them because, of course, they're like, what the hell is this? And also, y'all Muslims don't ever do anything for the community unless it's for another Muslim. Mm-hmm. And that's when we get what I think my favorite scene of the movie is, where scene as in like, I like the way it's shot and the feeling of it is, someone confronts Malcolm saying, like, this brother got beat up by the police at this place and they took him in, and like, he's going to die sitting in jail. Help us. And then this woman tells Malcolm, like, he's not going to do shit. They only care about other Muslims. And that's when Malcolm decides that he's going to bring his people down to the police station, and they have all these people outside. And he basically tells those cops, like, if you don't verify that this man, Brother Johnson, is in here and getting proper medical care, there's going to be a problem.
Well, not just out lined up outside, they're in formation.
In formation, mm-hmm. Beyonce. Mm-hmm. So then the entire community marches down to the hospital. And then it turns out to be a black doctor who comes out and says he's going to be fine. He's getting the best care he can. And that's when Malcolm does the signal, mm-hmm. and all the Nation of Islam members march in formation out. Mm-hmm. And then that's when one of the police sergeants says that's too much power for one man to have. Mm-hmm. And that's when we start getting, like, clearly their phones being tapped, mm-hmm. they're being harassed. That's also when we start realizing that the other brothers of the Nation of Islam are jealous maybe of him.
They definitely are, yes.
And then that's when they start harassing him. And that's when it becomes clear, like, we're told that there is a hit out on him. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, that's when Malcolm gets shot at a speaking engagement.
But, you know, he's saying things that scared these white people.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Can you imagine in 1965? Can you imagine? And what I think he kind of fucks up is his reaction to JFK.
We have 2 minutes left. I thought that the scene where, well, first of all, Malcolm marrying Betty felt like it just came out of nowhere, and then immediately she's like, I want to have a bunch of kids with you. And then we have Betty confronting Malcolm about Elijah Muhammad's extramarital affairs, and then Malcolm confronts Elijah, and he basically says, like, he needs to be fertile, like, saying some dumb shit. Mm-hmm. But that's when it's clear to Malcolm that, like, he fully needs to separate himself from this man, mm-hmm.
Who's been talking shit about him anyway.
Yeah. Then Betty confronts Malcolm, like, how can you not see that you're being betrayed? Like, everyone can see it but you. I also felt like that needed more time. We're told at one point that the Nation wanted to wire Malcolm's car to, like, have it explode on his ass.
Right.
So things were getting real hot. Then we get the segment where he goes to Egypt. I thought there were some nice shots, but again, it felt very rushed.
He comes back a little wiser.
He comes back, and then we get the moment where it seems like what they're trying to tell us is there was an earlier assassination attempt on him, because we hear a guy in the crowd at a speaking engagement yell, "Get your hand out of my pocket," to create a diversion, but nothing happens. And then on the night that Malcolm is actually assassinated, that same guy yells, "Get your hand out of my pocket," and then they throw like a smoke bomb. And so I thought that was creepy in hindsight.
Yes.
But there was an earlier attempt.
Well, and then in front of his wife and children.
I know. My last note is that at the end of the film, during the end credits, we get a scene with Nelson Mandela talking to children, which is, I mean, that's pretty major. What would you give Malcolm X?
It's not my favorite Spike Lee film.
No. Favorite being Do the Right Thing for me.
Yeah, most likely. I'm trying to think. Oh, Bamboozle.
I would love to have Spike Lee do another biopic, though.
Yeah.
Because I really liked how he handled this.
Yeah, it's got his stamp all over it. Those signature shots he does. Bamboozled, I love too, and I think is more powerful and subversive. I think we're chained to, you know, the real life story of this person, and I think biopics often feel a little more limited to me in that regard. But this is definitely one of the best biopics probably ever made.
So what would you give it?
3.5.
I would give it 3.5 out of 5 as well. That's all the time we have. Ta-ta. Mm.